Chapter 8. Tom Chist and the Treasure Box. An old-time story of the days of Captain Kidd. To tell about Tom Chist, and how he got his name, and how he came to be living at the little settlement of Henlopen, just inside the mouth of the Delaware Bay, the story must begin as far back as 1686, when a great storm swept the Atlantic coast from end to end. During the heaviest part of the hurricane, a bark went ashore on the Hen and Chicken Shoals, just below Cape Henlopen, and at the mouth of the Delaware Bay, and Tom Chist was the only soul of all those on board the ill-fated vessel who escaped alive. This story must first be told, because it was on account of the strange and miraculous escape that happened to him at that time that he gained the name that was given to him. Even as late as that time of the American colonies, the little scattered settlement at Henlopen, made up of English, with a few Dutch and Swedish people, was still only a spot upon the face of the great American wilderness that spread away, with swamp and forest, no man knew how far to the westward. That wilderness was not only full of wild beasts, but of Indian savages, who every fall would come in wandering tribes to spend the winter along the shores of the freshwater lakes below Henlopen. There for 4 or 5 months they would live upon fish, and clams and wild ducks and geese, chipping their arrowheads, and making their earthenware pots and pans under the lee of the sand hills and pine woods below the capes. Sometimes on Sundays, when the Reverend Hillary Jones would be preaching in the little log church back in the woods, these half-clad red savages would come in from the cold, and sit squatting in the back part of the church, listening stolidly to the words that had no meaning for them. But about the wreck of the bark in 1686. Such a wreck as that which then went ashore on the Hen and Chicken Shoals was a godsend to the poor and needy settlers in the wilderness where so few good things ever came. For the vessel went to pieces during the night, and the next morning the beach was strewn with wreckage, boxes and barrels, chests and spars, timbers and planks, a plentiful and bountiful harvest, to be gathered up by the settlers as they chose, with no one to forbid or prevent them. The name of the bark, as found painted on some of the water barrels and sea chests, was the Bristol Merchant, and she no doubt hailed from England. As was said, the only soul who escaped alive off the wreck was Tom Chist. A settler, a fisherman named Matt Abrahamson, and his daughter Molly, found Tom. He was washed up on the beach among the wreckage, in a great wooden box which had been securely tied around with a rope and lashed between two spars, apparently for better protection in beating through the surf. Matt Abrahamson thought he had found something of more than usual value when he came upon this chest, but when he cut the cords and broke open the box with his broad axe, he could not have been more astonished had he beheld a salamander instead of a baby of 9 or 10 months old lying half smothered in the blankets that covered the bottom of the chest. Matt Abrahamson's daughter Molly had had a baby who had died a month or so before. So when she saw the little one lying there in the bottom of the chest, she cried out in a great loud voice that the good man had sent her another baby in place of her own. The rain was driving before the hurricane storm in dim, slanting sheets, and so she wrapped up the baby in the man's coat she wore and ran off home without waiting to gather up any more of the wreckage. It was Parson Jones who gave the foundling his name. When the news came to his ears of what Matt Abrahamson had found, he went over to the fisherman's cabin to see the child. He examined the clothes in which the baby was dressed. They were of fine linen and handsomely stitched, and the reverend gentleman opined that the foundling's parents must have been of quality. A kerchief had been wrapped around the baby's neck, and under its arms and tied behind, and in the corner, marked with very fine needlework, were the initials T.C. "What do you call him, Molly?" said Parson Jones. As he spoke, with his back to the fire, warming his palms before the blaze, The pocket of the greatcoat he wore bulged out with a big case bottle of spirits which he had gathered up out of the wreck that afternoon. What do you call him, Molly?
I'll call him Tom, after my own baby.
That goes very well with the initial on the kerchief, said Parson Jones. But what other name do you give him?
Something to go with the sea.
I don't know, said Molly.
Why not call him Chist, since he was born in a chist out of the sea?
Tom Chist, the name goes off like a flash in the pan.
And so Tom Chist he was called, and Tom Chist he was christened.
So much for the beginning of the history of Tom Chist. The story of Captain Kidd's treasure box does not begin until the late spring of 1699. That was the year that the famous pirate captain, coming up from the West Indies, sailed his sloop into the Delaware Bay, where he lay for over a month waiting for news from his friends in New York. For he had sent word to that town asking if the coast was clear for him to return home with the rich prize he had brought from the Indian seas and the coast of Africa, and meantime he lay there in the Delaware Bay waiting for a reply. Before he left, he turned the whole of Tom Chist's life topsy-turvy with something that he brought ashore. By that time, Tom Chist had grown into a strong-limbed, thick-jointed boy of 14 or 15 years of age. It was a miserable dog's life he lived with old Matt Abrahamson, for the old fisherman was in his cups more than half the time, and when he was so there was hardly a day passed that he did not give Tom a curse or a buffet, or, as like as not, an actual beating. One would have thought that such treatment would have broken the spirit of the poor little foundling, but it had just the opposite effect upon Tom Chist, who was one of your stubborn, sturdy, stiff-willed fellows who only grow harder and more tough the more they are ill-treated. It had been a long time now since he had made any outcry or complained at the hard usage he suffered from old Matt. At such times he would shut his teeth and bear whatever came to him, until sometimes the half-drunken old man would be driven almost mad by his stubborn silence. Maybe he would stop in the midst of the beating he was administering, and, grinding his teeth, would cry out, "Won't he say not? Won't he say not? Well, then, I'll see if I can't make he say not." When things had reached such a pass as this, Molly would generally interfere to protect her foster son, and then she and Tom would together fight the old man until they had wrenched the stick or the strap out of his hand. Then old Matt would chase them out of doors, and around the house for maybe half an hour, until his anger was cool, when he would go back again, and for a time the storm would be over. Besides his foster mother, Tom Chist had a very good friend in Parson Jones, who used to come over every now and then to Abrahamson's hut upon the chance of getting a half dozen fish for breakfast. He always had a kind word or two for Tom, who during the winter evenings would go over to the good man's house to learn his letters, and to read and write, and cipher a little, so that by now he was able to spell the words out of the Bible and the almanac, and knew enough to change tuppence into four halfpennies. This is the sort of boy Tom Chist was, and this is the sort of life he led. In the late spring or early summer of 1699, Captain Kidd's sloop sailed into the mouth of the Delaware Bay and changed the whole fortune of his life. And this is how you come to the story of Captain Kidd's treasure box. The second old Matt Abrahamson kept the flat-bottom boat in which he went fishing some distance down the shore and in the neighborhood of the old wreck that had been sunk on the shoals. This was the usual fishing ground of the settlers, and here old Matt's boat generally lay drawn upon the sand. There had been a thunderstorm that afternoon, and Tom had gone down the beach to bail out the boat in readiness for the morning's fishing. It was full moonlight now, as he was returning, and the night sky was full of floating clouds. Now and then there was a dull flash to the westward, and once a muttering growl of thunder, promising another storm to come. All that day the pirate sloop had been lying just off the shore back of the capes, and now Tom Chist could see the sails glimmering pallidly in the moonlight, spread for drying after the storm.
He was walking up the shore homeward when he became aware that at some distance ahead of him there was a ship's boat drawn up on the little narrow beach, and a group of men clustered about it. He hurried forward with a good deal of curiosity to see who had landed, but it was not until he had come close to them that he could distinguish who and what they were. Then he knew that it must be a party who had come off the pirate sloop. They had evidently just landed, and two men were lifting out a chest from the boat. One of them was a Negro, naked to the waist, and the other was a white man in his shirt sleeves, wearing petticoat breeches, a Monterey cap upon his head, a red bandana handkerchief around his neck, and gold earrings in his ears. He had a long, plaited queue hanging down his back, and a great sheath knife dangling from his side. Another man, evidently the captain of the party, stood at a little distance as they lifted the chest out of the boat. He had a cane in one hand, and a lighted lantern in the other, although the moon was shining as bright as day. He wore jack boots and a handsome lace coat, and he had a long, drooping mustache that curled down below his chin. He wore a fine, feathered hat, and his long black hair hung down upon his shoulders. All this Tom Chist could see in the moonlight, that glinted and twinkled upon the gilt buttons of his coat. They were so busy lifting the chest from the boat, that at first they did not observe that Tom Chist had come up, and was standing there. It was the white man with the long, plaited queue and the gold earrings, that spoke to him. "Boy, what do you want here, boy?" he said, in a rough, hoarse voice. And then dropping his end of the chest, and without giving Tom time to answer, he pointed off down the beach, and said, "You'd better be going about your own business, if you know what's good for you, and don't you come back, or you'll find what you don't want waiting for you." Tom saw in a glance that the pirates were all looking at him, and then, without saying a word, he turned and walked away. The man who had spoken to him followed him threateningly for some little distance, as though to see that he had gone away as he was bidden to do. But presently he stopped, and Tom hurried on alone, until the boat and the crew, and all were dropped away behind, and lost in the moonlight night. Then he himself stopped also, turned, and looked back whence he had come. There had been something very strange in the appearance of the men he had just seen. Something very mysterious in their actions, and he wondered what it all meant, and what they were going to do. He stood for a little while thus looking and listening. Could see nothing, and could hear only the sound of distant talking. What were they doing on the lonely shore thus at night? Then, following a sudden impulse, he turned and cut off across the sand hummocks, skirting around inland, but keeping pretty close to the shore, his object being to spy upon them, and to watch what they were about from the back of the low sand hills that fronted the beach. He had gone along some distance in his circuitous return, when he became aware of the sound of voices that seemed to be drawing closer to him as he came toward the speakers. He stopped and stood listening, and instantly, as he stopped, the voices stopped also. He crouched there silently in the bright, glimmering moonlight, surrounded by the silent stretches of sand, and the stillness seemed to press upon him like a heavy hand. Then suddenly the sound of a man's voice began again, and as Tom listened he could hear someone slowly counting. 91, the voice began, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99, 100, 101, the slow, monotonous count coming nearer and nearer, 102, 103, 104, and so on in its monotonous reckoning. Suddenly he saw three heads appear above the sand hill, so close to him that he crouched down quickly with a keen thrill, close beside the hummock near which he stood. His first fear was that they might have seen him in the moonlight, but they had not, and his heart rose again as the counting voice went steadily on. 120, it was saying, and 21, and 22, and 23, and 20-4, and then he who was counting came out from behind the little sandy rise into the white and open level of shimmering brightness. It was the man with the cane whom Tom had seen some time before, the captain of the party who had landed. He carried his cane under his arm now, and was holding his lantern close to something that he held in his hand, and upon which he looked narrowly as he walked with a slow and measured tread in a perfectly straight line across the sand, counting each step as he took it. And 25, and 26, and 27, and 28, and 29, and 30. Behind him walked two other figures. One was the half-naked Negro, the other the man with the plated queue and the earrings, whom Tom had seen lifting the chest out of the boat. Now they were carrying the heavy box between them, laboring through the sand with shuffling tread as they bore it onward. As he who was counting pronounced the word 30, the two men set the chest down on the sand with a grunt, the white man panting and blowing, and wiping his sleeve across his forehead. And immediately he who counted took out a slip of paper and marked something down upon it. They stood there for a long time, during which Tom lay behind the sand hummock watching them, and for a while the silence was uninterrupted. In the perfect stillness Tom could hear the washing of the little waves beating upon the distant beach, and once the faraway sound of a laugh from one of those who stood by the ship's boat. 1, 2, 3 minutes passed, and then the men picked up the chest and started on again, and then again the other man began his counting. 30 and 1, and 30 and 2, and 30 and 3, and 30 and 4, he walked straight across the level open, still looking intently at that which he held in his hand, and 30 and 5, and 30 and 6, and 30 and 7, and so on, until the three figures disappeared in the little hollow between the two sand hills on the opposite side of the open, and still Tom could hear the sound of the counting voice in the distance. Just as they disappeared behind the hill there was a sudden faint flash of light, and by, as Tom lay still listening to the counting, he heard, after a long interval, a faraway muffled rumble of distant thunder. He waited for a while, and then arose and stepped to the top of the sand hummock behind which he had been lying. He looked all about him, but there was no one else to be seen. Then he stepped down from the hummock, and followed in the direction which the pirate captain and the two men carrying the chest had gone. He crept along cautiously, stopping now and then to make sure that he still heard the counting voice, and when it ceased he lay down upon the sand and waited until it began again. Presently, so following the pirates, he saw the three figures again in the distance, and, skirting around back of a hill of sand covered with coarse sedge grass, he came to where he overlooked a little open level space gleaming white in the moonlight. The three had been crossing the level of sand, and were now not more than 25 paces from him. They had again set down the chest, upon which the white man with the long queue and the gold earrings had seated to rest himself, the Negro standing close beside him. The moon shone as bright as day and full upon his face. It was looking directly at Tom Chist, every line as keen cut with white lights and black shadows, as though it had been carved in ivory and jet. He sat perfectly motionless, and Tom drew back with a start, almost thinking he had been discovered. He lay silent, his heart beating heavily in his throat, but there was no alarm, and presently he heard the counting begin again, and when he looked once more he saw they were going away straight across the little open. A soft, sliding hillock of sand lay directly in front of them. They did not turn aside, but went straight over it, the leader helping himself up the sandy slope with his cane, still counting and still keeping his eyes fixed upon that which he held in his hand. Then they disappeared again behind the white crest on the other side. So Tom followed them cautiously until they had gone almost half a mile inland. When next he saw them clearly, it was from a little sandy rise which looked down like the crest of a bowl upon the floor of sand below. Upon this smooth, white floor the moon beat with almost dazzling brightness. The white man who had helped to carry the chest was now kneeling, busied at some work, though what it was Tom at first could not see. He was whittling the point of a stick into a long wooden peg, and when, by and by, he had finished what he was about, he arose and stepped to where he who seemed to be the captain had stuck his cane upright into the ground, as though to mark some particular spot. He drew the cane out of the sand, thrusting the stick down in its stead. Then he drove the long peg down with a wooden mallet which the Negro handed to him. The sharp rapping of the mallet upon the top of the peg sounded loud to perfect stillness, and Tom lay watching and wondering what it all meant. The man, with quick dash repeated blows, drove the peg farther and farther down into the sand until it showed only 2 or 3 inches above the surface. As he finished his work there was another faint flash of light, and by another smothered rumble of thunder, and Tom, as he looked out toward the westward, saw the silver rim of the round, and sharply outlined thundercloud rising slowly up into the sky, and pushing the other and broken drifting clouds before it. The two white men were now stooping over the peg, the Negro man watching them. Then presently the man with the cane started straight away from the peg, carrying the end of a measuring line with him, the other end of which the man with the plaited queue held against the top of the peg. When the pirate captain had reached the end of the measuring line he marked a cross upon the sand, and then again they measured out another stretch of space. So they measured a distance 5 times over, and then, from where Tom lay, he could see the man with the queue drive another peg just at the foot of a sloping rise of sand, that swept up beyond into a tall white dune marked sharp and clear against the night sky behind. As soon as the man with the plaited queue had driven the second peg into the ground they began measuring again, and so, still measuring, disappeared in another direction which took them in behind the sand dune, where Tom no longer could see what they were doing. The Negro still sat by the chest, where the two had left him, and so bright was the moonlight, that from where he lay Tom could see the glint of it twinkling in the whites of his eyeballs. Presently from behind the hill there came, for the third time, the sharp rapping sound of the mallet driving still another peg, and then after a while the two pirates emerged from behind the sloping whiteness into the space of moonlight again. They came direct to where the chest lay, and the white man and the black man lifting it once more, they walked away across the level of open sand, and so on behind the edge of the hill, and out of Tom's sight. The Book of Pirates.